from Virginia to North Dakota, Georgia to California, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, they call it the For the People Act, but congressional Democrats are really taking aim at conservative free speech. Adam Brandon of FreedomWorks is here with details. President Trump has presented his fiscal year 2020 budget to Congress. Does it have a chance to pass? Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. A law that requires only American-built ships to deliver goods to U.S. islands, including Hawaii and Puerto Rico, is driving up the cost of living. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Colin Grabow of the Cato Institute. And when telling lies or spreading fake news becomes an accepted part of life, we have strayed from our core values. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The left is good at putting nice-sounding names on legislation. Think the Affordable Care Act that made health care anything but affordable. Now with the so-called For the People Act, or House Bill 1, they want to place restrictions on political free speech. Adam Brandon is president of FreedomWorks. He is here to walk us through the proposal. Adam, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Adam, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House of Representatives, which they, as everybody I think by now knows, took control of earlier this year, they have H.R. 1, and usually the piece of legislation that's given that designation is the single most important or signature legislation for a session of Congress. Tell us a little bit about H.R. 1 and what is involved in it.
H.R. 1 is called the For the People Act, and it's a Democratic bill that they, I believe, if they were sitting here on the phone, they would say this is going to open up our democratic process. When I read the bill, to me, it becomes a blatant assault on the First Amendment, and I believe it will have a chilling effect on political speech in our country.
Exactly what is incorporated in the bill or included in the bill that would take away free speech?
Every small dollar donor, and in politics today, a small dollar donor is less than $200, would have to make their names public. And I believe with the way the databases are so searchable today, this could have a chilling effect when someone doesn't want their fellow colleagues to know on the workplace that they just chipped in $5, $10, or $100 to a candidate. In fact, the ACLU, who we don't necessarily partner with on a lot of different issues, but sometimes we do, they came out against this bill for that very reason. And if you go back in time, the NAACP had a lawsuit against the state of Alabama back in the 1950s and 60s, and it was about donor disclosure, where the NAACP fought to keep their donor records private because of harassment that donors were facing. And we look at H.R. 1, the For the People Act, this would be an absolute assault on that very privacy. To us, Americans have a constitutional right to privacy.
Would this not in some way run afoul? There was a ruling a number of years back, Citizens United, where the Supreme Court of the United States weighed in on these matters. Adam, it strikes me this bill might run contrary to that ruling. What's your thoughts on that?
I believe so, but we're just talking about a part of the bill. There's other parts of the bill that get into federal financing of campaigns. There's parts of the bill that give the federal government control over redistricting. And that's what the Constitution has said, that the states have to do redistricting. And it also does things such as the FEC would get an odd number of votes, which I don't care if it's a Republican or Democrat in the White House, you would then weaponize the FEC, the Federal Elections Commission. So on many different grounds, I think there are legal challenges to this bill. However, if parts and pieces get through, it could be devastating, as I said before, have a chilling effect on political speech in our country.
Let's talk a little bit more about the impact on redistricting, because we have a census coming up next year. It happens every 10 years. 2020 will be the decennial census. And as a result of that, all the states, as you mentioned, will go through a redistricting process. When you look at H.R. 1, Adam, how does it attempt to infringe on the state's constitutional rights relative to redistricting?
Well, you've already, in the Constitution, it says that it's up to the states to decide how they're going to allocate their number of congressional representation in Washington. This would further just give the federal government authority to get in to decide if a state, if a district is just or not. And I believe this should be left up to the states to decide how they want to do it. This is a big part of federalism. If not, I think that this just gives too much power to Washington, D.C. to decide, you know, we don't like this district, we're going to change it. And to me, that becomes a slippery slope between centralizing power in Washington versus our federal system, where we're supposed to have a lot of power set back to the states.
When it comes to redistricting, isn't it, as they always say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder? When it comes to redistricting, whether or not a map is fair in a state, isn't that somewhat determined by which side of the partisan divide you happen to be on?
Sure does, but I would rather that be left up to the states to decide and not the federal government. So certain states may view things one way, and you do have certain laws in our country, going back from the Civil Rights Act, where you by law have to have majority-minority district, which in America today, as we get to a country that's heading very quickly to be a majority-minority country, I think there's going to be a lot of confusion on what a district actually has to look like. And I maybe have an idealistic version of things where I would prefer we don't group people up by identity into districts, but we figure out other ways to sort out our districts. But inherent, you're correct, this is a political process. And I think we stand a better chance of a republic if we let that political process set itself up state level than at the federal level.
Let's explore a little bit further. You mentioned a couple of minutes ago that part of H.R. 1 is a federal financing of elections. What are they proposing here?
It would be a 6-to-1. This bill sets up a 6-to-1 match of campaign contributions with taxpayer funds. So my concern is that the political parties, both Republican and Democrat, have such a stranglehold on our political process. If you go back to the 1780s, 1790s, our system was not designed to have these parties. In fact, Washington warned of factionalism. And so my fear is that if you have the grand poobahs of the different parties decide, okay, here is our endorsed candidate, it would be very easy for them to raise, say, that first $100,000, and then they get quickly matched with an additional $600,000. That, will have a chilling effect on a lot of insurgent campaigns. Even though I'm not a big fan of Alexandra Cortez and her bills, I think it's very cool in our system that someone could challenge a party establishment person and knock them out. I've supported candidates on the conservative side that have done the same thing. And I believe when you get federal funding into campaigns, that will have a chilling effect on the ability to have these insurgent candidates.
H.R. 1, of course, a Democratic priority in the House of Representatives, but the Senate is controlled by Republicans. Is it dead on arrival?
It is dead on arrival, and far too many of people I know are kind of counting on that.
Adam Brandon is president of FreedomWorks. Adam, tell us a bit about FreedomWorks and where can folks go on the web to learn more?
You can come to freedomworks.org.org or look us up on Facebook. That tends to be our most active community these days is the FreedomWorks Facebook page. We have 5 million fans on our Facebook page. It's our most engaging and lively conversation that we do. But what we're trying to do here is we're grassroots. We try and organize people on fiscal, conservative, economic issues. And we do sometimes get involved in issues like H.R. 1 when we look at as these are a direct threat to our constitutional rights.
Adam Brandon of FreedomWorks. Adam, thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, and we have activity both on the budget front in Washington, D.C., and a major development in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. We're going to talk about all of that today. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out by talking about the federal budget, something that actually hasn't been approved in decades, but President Trump is giving it the old college try in this past week. He released his budget. And what were some of the highlights and important parts of that?
President Trump released the fiscal year 2020 budget request. When the president introduces a budget, it's basically a visionary document that tells the American people what policy track the president prioritizes and what he's asking Congress to do. But you always have different budgets produced by at least the majority party in Congress, and then it's up for debate whether or not they bring it up for a vote and if it'll pass, and then whether it would have any binding impact on the appropriations. So this week, President Trump came out with the budget, and he's calling it a budget for a better America, promises kept, and taxpayers first. Certainly what we've seen since they passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, historic tax reform, we really have seen strong wage growth, higher productivity, and really solid macroeconomic benefits from tax reform. So I think that that's what the president is really trying to focus on in terms of keeping his promises for the taxpayers. He's also highlighting $2.7 trillion in spending cuts, calling that higher than any other administration in history. As part of these cuts, the president does maintain spending levels for the military, for our national defense, but he's going to let non-defense discretionary spending dramatically decrease, and then he'll continue to decrease that at a 2% level throughout the budget window. So that's how he generally gets to balance within the budget. It's not a 10-year balance, but the budget would balance within 15 years. Now, I know what you're thinking. 15 years, nobody ever budgets for 15 years in the future. That's certainly true here in Washington, and that's why I said at the beginning that this is just a visionary document, and the real details that matter are within the first couple of years.
As I mentioned earlier, we really haven't had a budget pass in, well, decades now. You've called this a visionary document, which is pretty much what it is. So this, Scott, marks the official start of the budget cycle. What comes next, and why is it that we never really actually get to a formal budget adoption?
Well, a lot of it is because there's highly controversial reforms that are proposed within a budget to have that spending cut, to have any sense of fiscal responsibility. So really what will happen here, the Budget Act of 1974 lays out a timeline where Congress has to propose a budget after the president has proposed his budget, and that'll happen possibly in March, but definitely in April. And then if they don't act on the budget within the Congress by, I think, May 15th, they can continue and start doing appropriations legislation without having passed a budget. I do think that the House Democrats will pass a budget, but I am highly skeptical that Senate Republicans will bring a budget up, just because there's no path forward for any kind of a budget agreement between the House and Senate. So they'll be operating underneath the spending levels that will be negotiated in a new spending cap agreement, and I would anticipate that happening probably in July or September. It has to happen by September 30th, though.
So we're going to continue to keep an eye on the federal budget process as it unfolds, since it's now officially underway. Let's switch gears now, Scott, and talk a little bit politics. A major new entry into the presidential race. Who got in this past week?
Well, it was Robert Francis O'Rourke, also known as Beto O'Rourke, and also known as the loser in the 2018 Senate election down in Texas to Senator Ted Cruz. Beto was a member of the House of Representatives from Texas and has really built a strong profile, has a very, very strong fundraising ability. He raised tens and tens of millions of dollars for that Senate race. You could argue that it was totally wasted since he lost, but I think he's looking to cash in with his own profile to make this presidential run, even though he hasn't won a statewide election in his life. Beto is a highly charismatic and effective communicator, but he doesn't have a ton of accomplishments in his belt.
One final thing here before you go, Scott. You're up with a new website on the Green New Deal, which continues to be at play. Tell us a bit about your website.
Well, Economic Armageddon is a website that is going to highlight some of the issues with the Green New Deal. We have a pretty compelling web video that's called The Goal is Control, and it really talks about how the socialist extremists and in the progressive wing of the party for Democrats are trying to impact every single part of your own life, whether it's green efficiencies within your home, the type of car you're able to drive, if you're able to fly a plane, You're also talking about free college tuition. You're talking about free housing, free money for people that are unwilling to work. There's all sorts of costs associated with this. Medicare for all means eliminating all private health insurance. You can't keep your doctor. You can't keep your pediatrician. It would really just be devastating in every single way to our economy. We put up the web video about a week ago, and right now I'm looking at it, and it has 299,000 views already. So we encourage everybody to check out economicarmageddon.com and see our video. The goal is control. There's a playback to 1964 with the Daisy ad that we think is a little interesting and fun to include. So we encourage you guys to check that out.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
So the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 250,000 members from all across the country, including all 50 states in the union. Our group is united because we believe in economic freedom. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can actually join Club for Growth for free.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The Jones Act requires that shipping to Hawaii and U.S. island territories be done with American-built ships and crews. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Colin Graybaugh of the Cato Institute about why this is driving up the cost of living in those areas.
If you wanted to ship a box of goods, a box of widgets, let's say, to Jamaica, you could hire literally any ship that can travel on the ocean to make that delivery. But if you wanted to ship the exact same box of goods to Puerto Rico from the United States, you would have to hire a ship that was American-built, American-crewed, and that flew an American flag. And while this might seem like a well-intentioned law, the consequences of it, of this law known as the Jones Act, have actually driven up the costs of shipping and therefore the cost of living in places like Puerto Rico and Hawaii and Alaska. And that's what we're going to take a look at here today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Colin Graybaugh. He is a policy analyst, a trade policy analyst at the Cato Institute, and he joins us now to discuss the Jones Act and an effort in Congress potentially at repealing it. Colin, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Before we get into the proposal that Senator Mike Lee has put out there that would repeal the Jones Act, let's talk a little bit of background here on what it is, because this goes back all the way to the 1920s, but it's something that I imagine most people probably don't encounter on a regular basis and maybe have never heard about. Tell us a little bit about what the Jones Act is.
The Jones Act is, technically, it's Section 27 of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, and it has four main provisions. So these provisions are that any vessels traveling between two points in the United States and carrying goods have to be U.S. flagged and registered. They have to be at least 75% U.S. crewed. They have to be at least 75% U.S. owned. And perhaps most importantly, they have to be built here in the United States.
So this is protectionism, basically, for the American shipbuilding industry, for the American shipping industry writ large. And that, I guess, in some ways, protects American jobs here at home, right?
Jones Act proponents would tell you that it does a few things. It's supposed to assure the United States of a shipbuilding capacity. That's certainly part of it. That can be used in time of war or national emergency. And also that it assures the United States a supply of merchant mariners that can serve aboard U.S. and commercial ocean-going ships during time of war to transport war supplies and equipment and so on and so forth. But the costs are also the costs are obvious and substantial. Basically, the most straightforward manifestation of the Jones Act or result is that it leads to higher shipping costs, higher transportation costs. These Jones Act ships that have to be built here in the United States are not cheap. They are commonly estimated to cost 4 to 5 times more than those built in Asian shipyards. In fact, there was a 2017 Congressional Research Service report which said that these coastal vessels, the kind of vessels you find in the Jones Act domestic trade, can be 6 to 8 times more expensive. We have the example of, actually just this past weekend, there was a new Jones Act ship commissioned or christened. It costs $209 million, and it's going to run between Hawaii and the West Coast. It has a cargo capacity of 3,600 TEUs. These are 20-foot equivalent units. Basically, two TEUs is roughly equivalent to a shipping container. In comparison, the biggest container ship in the world, the OOCL Hong Kong class, carries over 21,000 TEUs and costs $158 million. So you're getting six times the carrying capacity for $50 million less. And I think that's really, you know, the story of the Jones Act. So when you have less competition because all those foreign flag ships, they can't participate in the Jones Act trade, and you have high input costs, I mean, the inevitable result is higher shipping costs.
And those higher shipping costs are really right at the center of the proposal that Senator Mike Lee has to abolish the Jones Act. Senator Lee says that restricting trade between U.S. ports is a big loss for U.S. consumers and producers, and he says that he wants to make it so that Alaskans and Hawaiians and Puerto Ricans aren't being forced to pay higher prices for imported goods. This is a great example of kind of public choice dynamics in politics, Colin, and a great example of how special interests really control things in D.C. I wonder if you could take us through a little bit of the sort of the political dynamic here surrounding not just Lee's proposal, but the Jones Act in general.
Very logically, you have to ask yourself, well, why does this law persist? They have all these costs, and why don't we get rid of this thing? Because the costs are dispersed among 320 some million Americans, while the benefits are very concentrated to a limited number of hands. It's the shipbuilders, obviously, because we have to buy what they sell. That's great for them. The Jones Act carriers, the guys that transport goods from point A to point B, and their ships, because if we junk the Jones Act, the value of their ships would plummet because they could have competitors come in with cheaper ships at lower costs. And it's the unions who get to crew these ships. They get paid pretty handsomely, again, a result in part of a lack of competition. Last week, there were hearings in the House and Senate about the maritime industry, and they were just stacked front to back with Jones Act supporters. It was the unions, it was the carriers, it was the shipbuilders, and the American taxpayer never gets represented at these things.
We are talking with Colin Grebow. He is a trade policy analyst from the Cato Institute. Colin, just about a minute left here. Not a lot of time, but I do want to go back to something I said earlier. I mean, I think the Jones Act, you could certainly look at this as being something that, that helps protect and maintain American jobs, American shipbuilding jobs that maybe, I imagine the proponents of the Jones Act would say these jobs wouldn't be here if we didn't have something that was making sure shipping companies had to buy American. But there are obviously these consequences to protectionism. Are they worth it in order to maintain these jobs here in America?
To be perfectly clear, there would be some job losses entailed, but there also be job gains. Remember, every dollar that we pay extra for transportation costs is a dollar that we can't spend or invest in another part of the economy. And so we have a dynamic here. Just take Puerto Rico, for example. Puerto Rico, the GAO has documented that in Puerto Rico, they will often source, for example, jet fuel from Venezuela instead of the Gulf Coast, because once you take into account the cost of transportation, it's no longer economic to buy American. So, you know, these are all, it's the agriculture sector, it's the energy sector. I mean, all parts of the United States, we have fewer jobs in other sectors of the economy because of this law.
One of the interesting things about trade policy, about protectionism in trade policy, is that you always kind of have those consequences that you don't immediately see. You know, this is a law that affects the shipping industry, but it has all these kinds of knock-on effects, as you were just saying, Colin. We feel it in lots of other ways, even if we don't necessarily notice it. We are unfortunately out of time to talk about that for today, though. That is Colin Grebow. He is a trade policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Colin, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
And you can read more of Colin's work on the Jones Act and on trade in general at cato.org. Check out his latest blog post that takes a look right at Senator Lee's proposal. And for Reason Magazine, I am Eric Boehm. We will be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Do the ends justify the means? That age-old question is as relevant as ever to our nation's public policy debate. Here to talk about the importance of truth as a core principle is Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, with this American Radio Journal commentary.
If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan. Benghazi attack of September 11, 2012, caused by the reaction to an anti-Islamic film. The independence of the FBI questioned with the Steele dossier. Elizabeth Warren, a Cherokee. Trump accused of being a pathological liar. The first four tidbits I read above concern progressives. They're the representative of so many lies perpetrated on the American people, all in the name of the end results. The ends justifying the means has become the rallying tactic of the progressive movement, it seems. The last comment relates to President Donald Trump. Trump, who was accused by progressives of lying virtually nonstop. The question really is, have progressives gotten to the point where they believe that the ends justify the means? Concurrently, are progressives convinced that that very tactic of possibly lying to justify the ends is inappropriate for a conservative to do it? My purpose is not to judge whether or not any of the above comments are true or false, but to express my concern that when a society's moral fabric becomes so distorted that the ends justify the means in the minds of society, that society is likely to fail. What progressives misunderstand is that the public, most of whom do not fit into their stereotype of either progressive, liberal, moderate, Democrat, Republican, conservative, or libertarian, and the list goes on, will not distinguish between a progressive's lie and the claim by the progressive that Donald Trump is lying. Once you've desensitized a society to the dangers of lying, the impact of accusing someone of lying is lost. The ends simply do not justify the means. There was a time in our society when if someone was caught lying, they were disgraced and humiliated. In fact, former Vice President Biden was forced out of the presidential race in 1988 because he plagiarized his speech. The character of a nation and its core values determines whether or not a nation will survive. Be it the fall of the Roman Empire, and no, I was not there when that happened, the fall of the Third Reich or most other empires, the root causes usually point to some decay, self-indulgences, or other failures of character traits that are frequently rooted in Western civilization. A core value is your philosophy about your way of life. A core value is intrinsically who you are. The core value is your character, your leadership, and your upbringing, and your frame of reference. In Western civilization, those traits directly or indirectly relate back to Judeo-Christian principles. In the United States Marine Corps, for example, we teach leadership principles and leadership traits. Loyalty, justice, take responsibility, dependability, and courage are to name just a few. These principles and traits guide us in our dealings with fellow service members and the civilian leadership that we work for. A society's characters are the principles or the structures under which the society functions and serve as boundaries of acceptable behavior within a society. These boundaries can change over time. If the change is well thought out, the society will flourish. If the change is poorly thought out, the unintended consequences may, in fact, become the failure of that society. Many Americans today are confused about our national character. What we stand for is not just as clear as it once was for many. A prime example of the confusion and source of much of the perceived problem of the deterioration of our core values is the institutionalization of the lion as a way of life. In the United States, our nation has proclaimed its Judeo-Christian heritage in the Declaration of Independence. It says, and we quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," unquote. Our laws and frame of reference have been based upon such principles. This does not imply that our nation is governed by religious leaders, but that such Judeo-Christian principles serve as the framework for our national character. What we as a nation stand for. A law, on the other hand, is intended to be followed. A core value is intended to be lived. Central to any national character is for a person to accept personal accountability for their actions. Accepting that a lie is a lie and that ends do not justify the means are central to our national character if we are to survive. Being accountable for your actions is a core value. Taking responsibility for your actions is a core value. The ethics of the means to the end are as critical as the end itself in our way of life. It is our national character at stake, no more, no less. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WCPC-AM in Tupelo, Mississippi, WITK-AM in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Pennsylvania, and KWDF-AM in Alexandria, Louisiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.